May it please the court. I am Peter Rucheski of the Defiance Law Firm. Defiance being the historical name of Glenwood Springs, which is where my office mainly practices. We are here today almost entirely because of the due process rights that are at issue and are in danger through the current system that we have, that which is our system of punitive contempt under Rule 107. It is an area of law that is not well defined in many respects. It is not well regulated, so to speak. The effect on our citizens is that they face jail time, which is very much like facing, if not exactly to the citizens, like facing jail time in criminal cases. The vast majority of them being misdemeanor cases, although there is the occasional prosecution in a child support case, as we know, in which there is a reading of the right to a jury trial, meaning that the county attorney is asking the court to possibly impose 1 year or more in jail. However, in this particular case, there was no request that the right to a jury trial be advised of the defendant, and the defendant faced up to 6 months in jail. 6 months in jail for what? Well, for punitive contempt in failure to pay child support. Punitive contempt for up to 6 months for failure to pay child support, according to the, I don't want to say charging document, I guess it's more accurate to say complaint, that he had again failed to pay child support, that he had been punished for multiple times before, and that went back 24 years. Why did I initially say it's an area of law that is not well regulated? Well, looking at it through the eyes of the citizen, whether he goes to criminal court for third-degree misdemeanor harassment, which carries with it a maximum penalty of 6 months in jail, for getting in a fight with his wife that didn't involve much in the way of injury, or whether or not he goes before a different court and faces 6 months in jail for failure to pay child support in complete, in total, for even 1 month. A person can be brought into child support court for contempt purposes for paying $300 1 month instead of the allowed $750 just for 1 month. And that can be 6 months in jail. Is it practical that it happens that way? No, of course. What judge would send somebody to jail for 6 months for not paying approximately half of 1 month's worth of child support? Things like this happen. Maybe not exactly that scenario, but there's a scenario where a citizen went before a court, very unsophisticated, didn't have any money. The government was trying to throw him in jail for not paying the same child support that he'd been found guilty of going back 24 years. And it was the court's duty under our constitutions, state and federal, for the court to inquire about his indigent status. And once the court did, it was the court's duty to make a certain inquiry that went a certain way. It was also the court's duty, no matter how many times the contemnor had been before the court, to ensure that the contemnor knew what charges were against the contemnor before the contemnor could decide knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently, whether or not he was going to say guilty or not guilty to the charges against him.
Counsel, how can we conclude in this case that the trial court abused its discretion when the court repeatedly inquired of the defendant whether he understood his rights, and the court even said, you know, do you want an attorney? Do you need an attorney? And he declined. he didn't ask for an attorney. He didn't ask for even more time. He basically didn't make any of his needs made known to the court, but it was an inability to pay. He was more than willing and, in fact, anxious to say, they're right, I haven't paid child support. He had more than ample opportunity to ask their lawyer, to ask for more due process. He was given that, and he just declined it. So how can we conclude that the trial court abused its discretion under those circumstances?
Analogy would be in that case in which the defendant is charged with harassment for getting into a fight with his wife. He would be very sorry and lay himself prostrate before the court because he had made his wife angry and he had upset her. And he'd say, I am guilty for why I'm here. I am very sorry that I upset her. And if the court's inquiry didn't go beyond whether or not he simply upset his wife terribly or made her feel bad, then he can't plead guilty to harassment, because harassment has an English meaning, but that is of no import. In criminal law and in corollary criminal law, there are elements of a crime. And in this particular case, no matter how willing he was to lay himself prostrate before the court and to feel as though he, under the gun, under the crosshairs of the government, which has put him in jail before for not paying child support, and who knows whether he was ever advised as to the defenses to failure to pay child support and hold on in part. He simply said, I'm guilty of why I'm here. There was no proper inquiry as to whether or not he knew the elements of the charges against him, and based on that knowledge of his elements, then made a knowing and intelligent waiver of his rights, due process rights under the federal and state constitution.
Mr. Ruchesky, at the beginning of the hearing, there was a general advisement to about four or five different people. Tell me what was insufficient in that advisement.
Well, the advisement to the four or five different people is not a sufficient advisement to a particular individual.
Well, he was among those individuals.
But we don't know what he understood. If this area of law was not well developed, then I would agree that there might be an issue there. But the area of law is well developed in two ways. In one way, there are several cases in which even the transcripts of what were said during the trial court were laid out in the appellate court opinion regarding whether or not he was indigent and the inquiry that was to be made by the court. In several of those cases with several of those transcripts, the Court of Appeals said, this is what should have been done, this is what wasn't done. And this case fits squarely within that lack of proper colloquy as to whether or not he was indigent. Also, it is very well developed as to what needs to be done regarding knowledge of the individual elements. It is extremely rare, if not almost unheard of in a criminal case, that a person pleads guilty to a misdemeanor or a felony without there being a written advisement, something that the Court of Appeals could look at from the trial transcript that says, oh yes, here are the elements right here, and here is the signature of the defendant. And depending on the county, some of them even have the defendant's initial, each individual element. And everything is laid out there for them. And besides that, generally, if not always, the trial court repeats everything orally. And so, why don't we have that in criminal contempt? It is an area of law in which the courts, there being no right to a jury trial, even though there's a right to a jury trial in a criminal case of harassment, having no right to a jury trial with 6 months or less, the court may feel paternalistic. The court may feel, well, this is an area that's under the purview of the courts, and I can take care of things, and I've been doing this for a long time, and don't worry about it, because when it comes time for the defendant to be sentenced, I'll make an appropriate sentence. This is I speaking on behalf of a hypothetical court. But that kind of power should never, ever be given to anyone in our government. It should be checks and balances. It should be regulated. It should be according to a set of standards. In my opinion, there is no excuse for a person who is facing up to 6 months in jail to not have a proper advisement form and to not have a proper plea form in written form, spelling out all of their particular rights.
Now,
yes, sir.
Yeah. To the extent that your argument asserts an improper advisement, at the sentencing hearing, didn't father's attorney specifically concede that the advisement was adequate?
No, that was me. And we didn't concede that the advisement was adequate. That was the basis of our motion to withdraw. The defendant, when he initially saw me in court, had stated to me that he had pled guilty, because I was there and I had heard what he had to say, and I inquired of him what he pled guilty of. I knew his family, as I stated in the record.
Well, my question, I think, was a little more narrow.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'll say you, if you were the trial counsel.
I was. Well,
did you tell the court, quote, in fact, father was properly advised, unquote?
That was regarding a different advisement. As I was explaining, when the contender came to me, he told me that he was advised that he wasn't allowed to have an attorney if it was less than 6 months in jail. That was his original explanation. That was upon which I had inquired of the next judge, the one who was now the permanent judge rather than the visiting judges, whether or not I could have transcripts so that we could get the advisement to see whether or not he had been advised that he was not allowed to have an attorney with less than 6 months in possible jail time. That exact issue had actually just occurred in another case in a neighboring county in the same district with some of the same judges, that another judge did in fact say exactly that. The judge denied my request for a transcript. I offered to pay for them myself, so I did. When I got a hold of the transcript, he was properly advised as to whether or not the 6 months in the right to an attorney, that was all properly done by one of the judges. What was improper in the transcript is what we are here for on appeal today. What I noticed was the colloquy in which he pled guilty was completely devoid of usually the most important element of the crime, which is the defense that you don't have the ability to pay. It changes the crime from one of an intent crime to one of a specific, I just lost the word.
Strict liability.
Strict liability. Thank you very much. From one of a strict liability.
Okay, so your argument boils down to he was never told that inability to pay would be a defense, at least to criminal contempt.
I wouldn't say that the argument boils down to that, but I would say that if there was a most important issue, it would be that.
Okay.
Secondarily, it would be the lack of proper inquiry as to whether or not he was indigent and therefore should have had an attorney in the beginning rather than just before his hearing.
Let me follow that up. I apologize. Did the lower court make any inquiry of him as to whether he had an ability to pay? Forgetting about indigency in terms of, you know, appointed counsel, is there anything in the record indicating that he was asked about ability to pay?
I don't believe there was.
Isn't that alone a fatal defect, wholly apart from, you know, whether he got the right advice?
A fatal defect on the part of the contender or on the part of the government?
The government.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, thank
their inability to inquire, their inability to advise him that that is an element of the crime before he pleads guilty is in and of itself, right then and there, the end of the inquiry, in my opinion.
So either has to be advised that that's a defense, or the judge has to make an inquiry of him as to whether he has the ability to pay, but the government loses either way.
No, worded that way, and I'm just letting the court know that I'm down to a minute and 10 seconds. And
save your time if you wish.
Okay. The answer to that question would be that it's questionable whether or not inability to pay when pleading guilty is actually simply a defense or is a necessary element to the crime. I know that there's a hybrid application there, but for the purposes of pleading guilty, it's considered an element of the crime, is my decision.
Thank you.
Do I push any buttons or anything?
No, your time is automatically saved.
Okay.
I apologize for the lengthy question.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Cassie Coleman with Worrell, Durrett, Janes, and Gavrell, also in Glenwood Springs, attorney registration 37270. This is, the facts are very straightforward. This is a standard contempt action brought by the county to collect its public debt and any child support arrears. In 1985, Mr. Roletto, the father in this case, was ordered to pay support for one child of $150 per month. That order was never modified. In October 2006, the child of this case emancipated, and so that was the time frame. Mr. Roletto didn't pay his child support. This was the fourth contempt that was brought against him. At the time the child emancipated, Mr. Roletto still owed almost $15,000 in child support arrears and public debt. There's a strong public policy for the state to collect the debt it spent in public assistance when a mother has to go on assistance, or a father, because the other parent is not supporting the child. Ever in the third contempt brought against Mr. Roletto in 2002, as a sanction, he was ordered to pay $100 per month toward the arrears. He did not pay that. At the time this contempt was brought in May of 2010, the contempt action was brought based on the arrears payment because there was no longer a current support obligation. Mr. Roletto's obligation since October of 2006 was solely the $100 per month. That would be the only lawful order still in effect to pay off the $15,000 that he owed. He again did not pay. And each month of non-payment is a separate contempt, or a separate contempt could be brought for each month of non-payment. Under 1410.115, a judgment enters for each month child support is not paid.
Did the lower court make any inquiry or finding that he had the ability to pay?
Mr. Roletto stated he was guilty. He did not pay his child support.
No, that didn't answer my question. I'm sorry.
The court did advise him of the elements of contempt, one of them being it was a willful noncompliance.
Well, I'm not sure what that would mean to a non-lawyer. So let me come back to my question, please. Did the lower court make any specific inquiry of him or finding that he had the ability to pay?
I am not certain at this point. Looking back at the advisement was this colloquy between the court and Mr. Roletto, at which he said, I'm guilty for not paying my child support. He talked about having his license suspended. Whether it went further, once he waived his rights and admitted to the contempt, there was nothing else required at that point. The court had advised of the four elements of contempt under In Re Marriage of Newspeck, and it isn't a requirement that he have the current ability to pay and punitive. In a remedial sanctions, current ability to pay is a requirement. Under punitive, it's the ability to pay at the time.
But that was preceded by more general advisement to various individuals that included Mr. Roletto.
Correct.
And that advisement included that he and the others had a right to an attorney.
Correct. The court specifically said you have the right to have an attorney representing you. The other matter here is...
Well, let me say that for a minute. So it's your position that inability to pay would not be a defense to punitive contempt?
Inability right now. If the contempt is brought today, remedial contempt, and In Re Marriage of Newspeck sets forth the two different standards for remedial versus punitive. In a remedial contempt, which we did not plead, it is a present ability to pay that must be proven by a preponderance. We have pled punitive, which is my burden as county attorney to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the ability to pay at the time the payments were not made. So then when it comes to time for advisement and inquiry into indigency, that's a separate consideration because you may be indigent today, but you weren't 4 years ago at the time the contempt occurred.
Okay, was he advised that inability to pay as these monthly obligations came due was a defense?
I believe he was advised, and I can't cite to the transcript at this time, but I believe he was advised to all four elements that were required, and one of those is that it was a willful, and generally the court goes into willful means you could have and you didn't.
Well, let me ask you this question, because you're making the distinction between punitive and remedial and the time at which he did not have ability to pay. The general advisement to the group of four or five people, including him, was that the county has to prove that he willfully violated the court orders, and that is that you have the ability to either pay all or part, at least of what you have in order. So was that clear to him when he had the ability to pay?
I believe it was clear. All of them were, we had pled punitive, and that is the punitive advisement. It also, that advisement goes through, it's the county's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is clearly not the burden of a remedial sanction.
So how is the advisement different on remedial then, on that ability to pay? How would the wording be different?
The advisement's not as stringent because it is not, it doesn't have any possible criminal attachments. The same rights don't apply, such as the right to remain silent. The entire advisement is completely different. NewSpec sets it out as you have the ability right now to pay. And the judge that gave the advisement was a rotating visiting judge. The current judge advises on remedial that it's similar to Barry Bonds. If you're not going to testify and you can right now, you go to jail. So can you pay right now or you go to jail? Whereas it's retroactive looking in the punitive. But all of these people that were advised with Mr. Rileto on that day, it had all been pled as punitive. The other point is the U.S. Supreme Court recently dealt with the issue of due process rights in child support contempt actions, and that's Turner v. Rogers, which is 564 U.S., and I don't have the page yet. And in that case, it specifically stated, or it held, that there are other considerations that may make an advisement or other due process considerations that assist pro se defendants, and specifically in child support cases. And that case, I believe, it's definitely persuasive. That case specifically found that where a mother was pursuing a contempt against the father on her own pro se and did not involve the state, he was not entitled to counsel. But it also went on that any deficiencies in that could have been cured through other means, which is also set forth in the Dooley case that was cited in my brief. In this case, this, first of all, it was Mr. Rileto's fourth contempt. He'd been advised before. He'd received the packet of a motion for contempt citation, a citation for contempt, and the order for the contempt citation. All of those set forth the possible sanctions, the possible elements, when he's to be there. And then he gets advised again. And the holding of Turner v. Rogers essentially said that other mechanisms are in place to ensure the due process rights of pro se litigants in child support contempt cases. And I believe that is what's going on here. Not only was Mr. Rileto advised for the fourth time about his child support obligation and the possible remedies or possible sanctions for contempt of court, there were other pleadings that he was served with, that he knew what his rights were. And so any deficiencies in the actual advisement were harmless because they would have been cured by the documents that he also received in this case.
Now, were each of those four contempt remedial or punitive?
The three prior ones, I believe, were both. They were remedial and punitive. On one, he pled guilty and a judgment entered. That was the only sanction. The second one, he stipulated to contempt. The third one, he pled guilty to contempt, and that was the only time the record reflects any sentence was imposed. And he was sent to jail at that point, and then work release was authorized. That's the time the arrears payment was court ordered as well. So in each of those, based on my review of the record in this case, those were all pled jointly based on the state's child support forms that are promulgated by the State Office of Department of Human Services. The 2010 contempt was specifically only punitive. The other issue is we keep talking about this as though it's a criminal act. This is not. It clearly falls under the civil rules. It was brought pursuant to Rule 107 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. There's a civil statute, 14-14-110, that specifically authorizes contempt to be brought to enforce post-dissolution or child support orders. If it is a criminal act, it's clearly a felony. And that wasn't pursued here, but 14-6-101 specifically provides that non-support of your family is a felony act. So all the discussion about misdemeanors is entirely irrelevant. The statute of limitations, if any, falls under the civil rules. And again, there every month that Mr. Roletto refused to pay child support, even that $100 per month of arrears, the statute would have rerun because he's continuing to be ordered to pay that and he's continuing to not pay it. You know, it's a separate contempt could be brought that started June of 2002. A separate contempt could be brought for July 2002. A separate contempt could now be filed for April 1st, 2013 because he's still under a court order. His noncompliance on the first or the due date of each payment sets that statute back again.
Did you identify a particular date in the motion for contempt?
We did. And it covered the entire time frame in part to get from the time he was ordered in 1985 until the current time that the contempt was filed. That was to establish how the amount of $15,000 was calculated. The contempt was brought based on the $100 per month of unpaid child support. Attached to that is an affidavit and an arrears calculation that set forth each month the payment due and the amount received and the totals. So that was all set out. The contempt time frame fell during that point, which is why the argument has been raised about the double jeopardy. But again, In Re Marriage of Newsbeck specifically held that multiple contempts can be brought for the same child support arrearage. And in that case, the mother brought contempt against the father for non-payment under a remedial and punitive based on the same arrearage. So it's not the exact same factual situation we have here, but the holding was clear that that multiple contempts can be brought. Otherwise, we would be in a situation of having to file contempts every single month to preserve the right to keep bringing them rather than lumping them together. He still has not complied with paying the support order that was entered around the time I was in kindergarten. And this child support and public debt remains due and owing. There aren't double jeopardy issues that apply, and this was the first contempt that was brought based on the arrears payment, the court order arrears payment that still was not complied with. I don't believe there were any errors in the advisement. The strongest argument about the erroneous advisement is the right to counsel, which again is not absolute based on the Turner holding, but also it was cured. Mr. Rucheski was appointed counsel about 9 months prior to sentence being imposed in this case. During that time, he obtained nearly 7 continuances. So any error or any harm caused by not advising Mr. Roletto of his right to counsel was certainly cured by appointing Mr. Rucheski with more than sufficient time to deal with any errors in advisement. And in fact, he filed several motions to do exactly that. So I don't believe there was any improper advisement. All these people were advised the same as they almost always are. They are advised jointly and then separately inquired as to whether or not they understood those rights. Mr. Roletto was advised, you have the right to have a lawyer representing you. His response to that was something about his driver's license, that there was no statement that he wanted a continuance to seek counsel. There was no request for counsel. He was clearly advised of that and said, I'm guilty of why I'm here. And I believe that's an adequate, knowing, voluntary admission of contempt of court, especially seeing that this was a history. It wasn't his first rodeo. He'd been in there several times. He knew what his obligations to his children are. Again, this also isn't his only child support case. He was advised on other cases as well. And for him to now say he didn't know what was going on, I believe is not supported by the record. And again, reflecting on the due process considerations that can be implied through the Dooley case and Turner, that it's not just the advisement alone, but you look at the supporting documents and here, all the motions, the orders of the court, the advisement all taken in total are sufficient advisement. And we'd request that you affirm the trial court's imposition of sanctions that were entered about 18 months ago now that were only 30 days.
Could you just briefly respond to your opponent's suggestion that the court had an additional duty to also inquire regarding indigency?
I don't believe it did after he waived his right. If he had said, I need a continuance to seek counsel, or I've spoken with an attorney or something, that is the point, then the court would have said, you could be appointed if you qualify, here's our form, or go downstairs and get our form. At that point is when the inquiry and indigency would have arisen. The other issue is that could be taken as an admission of guilt if in the event he says, no, I don't qualify. And if remedial sanctions were being sought or punitive and he's saying he has the ability to pay for his attorney, it could be considered an admission to the contempt.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So is this correct? I have 46 seconds left in rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, then what I'd like to say is, if we assume that the contemnor was properly advised because he happened to be sitting in the courtroom when potentially some other people were properly advised, we are playing loose and fast with the due process rights of the contemnor. There's also no way that him, meaning the contemnor, having 7 months of representation by counsel, cured anything. He had already pled guilty before I got myself appointed, struggled for several months with the court with my right to have transcripts paid for by the court, which I had to pay for myself, only to make a brief and a motion, which the court only considered for 5 minutes before ruling. If you'll notice in the transcript, the judge didn't have it until and went back for 5 minutes to review the motion before making his ruling.
I believe your time is exhausted. We appreciate your argument.
Thank you.
We will issue a written opinion in due course.